welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated. Today, what we're going to do is a little bit of an experiment. We're going to cover four topics. Topics today are going to be lessons that we've learned over the last year. This show has been on since almost exactly last year. One of the things that we've been able to do is talk to a lot of different people about a lot of different topics. So we're going to talk about that. Another thing we're going to talk about is why we're struggling to fix our own mental health. And then we're going to talk about generational differences and the implication of those. And also new ways of coping. I'm going to share a little bit of a personal story. And there may be one more bonus topic. So I wanted to start today with a little bit about the lessons from last year. I'm not really sure how healthy it was to start a podcast after you lose a job and get a divorce and go through a lot of difficult situations, because you may not be the most optimistic person in the first place. We conducted 40 plus interviews. And just to give you an example about the topics we covered, we talked about how indigenous people were the victims of American colonialism that was rooted in religion and executed by our founding politicians. We talked about segregation, which has left black people in America in isolated and in ghettos and with no way out. And it's been going on since the beginning of slavery, really, and it's just getting worse. We also talked about how more and more middle-class Americans rely on food donations to eat, meaning regular middle-class folks, you might say, are earning the median income, still at the end of every month have to go to a food bank or some other sort of source for just to eat. We had several shows about healthcare and the healthcare system and why it's so expensive, and the profit focus is leading to service cuts and higher prices. That was a huge focus for us. A lot of it has to do with the fact that both Habanero and I have healthcare backgrounds. But what's happening is more and more Americans are just putting off care. They're not getting the meds they need. They're not getting the primary care visits they need. And they're just getting sicker and sicker. And that's driving up healthcare costs and making people miserable. And the other thing that we wanted to bring up a little bit about was that more and more white people are suffering. I think there was a period of time where we went through, black and indigenous and people of color were being marginalized. And I think it's involving more and more white people, the middle class, rural Americans. And I think that's what you're seeing in politics. And as a part of all of this, what came up quite frequently was the role of white privilege. And that if you are white, and especially if you're rich and white in America, you are part of the bounty. You are part of the success. And one of the more humbling things about the show for me was that I really had to open my own eyes, because honestly, I don't think white people think about this stuff. And for me, it was very difficult to blame people when they're not thinking about something. But now the time has come where it's right in your face and really acknowledging about the truth about that. In fact, I even had someone even said to me, you're realizing all these things, maybe you should use your white privilege. And I was like, well, yeah. So that's something I've had to think about and embrace and carry forward, is that, I think we do have an obligation, especially as a white guy in America who definitely has shared a lot of success due to the fact probably that I am white. The other thing that came up is that our government does not seem to represent us. This comes across in healthcare. This comes across in housing. This comes across in wages. They're just not growing. And it's really hard to look away. I think that you can see it on CNN or you can see it on Fox or wherever you go for news. But really, underlying all of that is that our government is not supporting us in ways that it may be used to. And Americans are feeling it. And we feel like we're being ignored. And I'm not talking about even the white privilege folks. I'm talking about everybody. So that's another thing that came up, is that it seems like we are unabashedly in the palms of corporations. And I don't think anyone that I've met is really going, yeah, that is the problem. But yet there's a lot of frustration and disgruntled people. We try to focus on solutions. And so what can we do to solve some of these heavy duty problems? And one of them is get behind social and economic justice, healthcare, housing, and wealth transfer. And wealth transfer, this show has never been about prescribing policy, and I'm not about to do that today. But it's becoming clearer and clearer that the wages in this country are not growing fast enough to support the healthcare needs and the food, the basic services, housing, food, transportation. People are just not earning enough. There's a social component that is rooted in race that is also underpinning all of this. And I think we just need to be honest about it, that if we're going to demand something, it really should be around wealth transfer, wealth redistribution. The system is not working. It is not American, in my opinion. The second thing I would do is, for all the white guys out there and white women out there, use your privilege for good and acknowledge that you may have it and acknowledge that you may need to lose it or share it. And if we're not willing to share, that's a deeper issue. That's a deeper problem in America. And I would encourage all of us to look in the mirror and say, hey, how can we make this a more equitable society? And the last thing that I would say as a solution is, we've got to work together and stop with the finger pointing and the hate and the left and the right and the jokes and the criticism. And it's just tiring and it doesn't go anywhere. So the second topic I want to talk about today is came up at a coffee shop. I was with a friend of mine and he said to me, why, with all the evolution that humans have done, why have we not figured out our mental health? We've got mass shootings. There's an app called the Insight Timer, which has over 500,000 users. Many Americans live in social isolation despite social media. Many of us are exposed to various forms of trauma, stress at work, stress at home, traffic, suicide rates among men are going up. There's widespread use of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, for depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder. And so it's pretty clear that we have a big mental health crisis in this country. And so the question is, why haven't we figured it? And I just said, I'm sitting in a coffee shop just thinking, and I said, you know, when didn't we have mental health issues? And the first thing I would say is, my guess is that we've always had mental health issues. But when didn't we, or were we least likely to have them? And one answer is when we're too tired to think. And this isn't to say that ancient peoples who were, you know, actually building their homes and the hunters and gatherers weren't stressed and full of fear. But the fact is that when you're tired, you tend to sleep and think less. And that's why exercise is so important. So I think that's one thing. And the other thing is, when we feel safe, I think we're less likely to have mental health issues. And if you think about or know about any of the therapies, meditations, guided meditations, or anything that goes into treating folks who have these, I don't want to say illnesses, but have mental health challenges, when they feel safe, when they feel they have family, when they feel they have friends, when they feel loved and appreciated, and when they love themselves or we love ourselves, mental health issues go away. So community is a big part of this. And the last thing that I would point to is a common experience. You know, when I think about when America itself was most together, that I'm aware of, it was probably during and after, or even before, during and after World War II, when the economic depression was affecting everybody, when the war was affecting everybody, and then when the good times were affecting everybody, but probably members of the BIPOC community, which, as I said before, is just an underlying injustice in the United States of America. So it's pretty obvious that, you know, community and a common experience can also reduce mental illness because we're all in it together. So again, that kind of goes back to this feeling and the sense of community. So no real surprise here. And again, I'm no therapist and I'm certainly no social scientist, but you know, exercise in society where fewer people in the past perform physical labor, you know, that could definitely help with some of the mental health issues. It's also pretty well known that social isolation is not good for mental health. You don't feel loved, and any lack of social connection and reinforcement. And, you know, the work of self-love every day when you're alone is hard work. And I think that people who try and do it every day are exhausted. And that just makes it even harder to keep a calm mind and a quiet mind. But I would also argue that part of our mental health problem in this country is this comparison culture we live in. And it's rooted in individualism and it's fueled by social media. And in my mind, it drives us apart and it contributes to our mental health challenges. And even when more people have access to us, it also pushes us away. Sure, our common experience is social media, but our common experience is also individualism, which leads to isolation. And what I mean by that is that social media isolates us because in the end, we're comparing ourselves to other people and other situations that we see, which only might be real. There's so much information. When people are on social media, they literally create a world that they want to present. And who's going to present the dark side, the murky side, the fight with the spouse, the fight with the kids, the waiting, the honking their horn in traffic? No one's going to share that. So that's what we're kind of left with. And individualism and this comparison culture also drives us to buy stuff. And when we buy stuff, we can feel momentary gratification, but then we get the bill. And unless we're wealthy enough, you know, we feel the bill and we have to pay the bill. Some would even argue that materialism is just false, and it really isn't that fulfilling, and it furthers social isolation. So then you layer in these facts that baby boomers are dealing with aging and dying. Families are under significant pressure from lower wages, and costs are doing nothing but increasing. And young people, and we'll talk about this in a minute as well, see a country with less economic opportunity and a climate that is increasingly creating catastrophes. You know, what can be done about this mental health issue? You know, again, I don't have all the answers, but certainly one is social connections. And a lot of people know this. I think people who have more social connections probably do seem more mentally healthy. And I'm not a counselor or a therapist, but I've done enough research and self-help to believe that being kind makes you feel better. And being kind can be as simple as saying hello or just passing someone and helping them out. You know, being just, if you recognize someone in need or help, just help them or say, how are you doing? Those acts can make people feel better. Not judging makes you feel better. I think that I remember times when I was younger, it was easy for me to judge people for all the wrong reasons. Maybe I thought they were less intelligent. Maybe I thought all kinds of different things that are just wrong. I mean, we're all people and there really isn't a difference among us. We all have gifts, so we should really stop the judging. And the other thing that we can do is stop blaming ourselves and stop blaming others for our hurt at the same time. You know, there's a lot of people beating up themselves or blaming themselves. I think people, you know, when you talk to people who, you know, are homeless, they're embarrassed, they want to work. It's not that they're taking advantage of the system. And I think the more we can have empathy for people, the more we can reduce some of these mental health challenges. You know, we're each enough. One of the things that I really think about in mental health issues is that people feel like they're not enough. They're not good enough. They're not achieving enough. And they blame themselves or they blame society or both. And it becomes a vicious cycle. And they speculate about who's doing what and why they're not getting ahead. And really, we all should understand that each of us has the capacity to be a good, kind, successful human being. And that should be nurtured. And this comparison culture of individualism is not helping us. So, you know, I'm fortunate to be able to have this platform to talk about these things, but I feel it's important to talk about them. So again, I'm thankful, and I'm thankful for you to be listening. The next topic I wanted to go through was generational differences. And this was highlighted by the holidays. When I was home, my mom was there and she's 92, and I'm not sure how much longer she's going to be with us. My brothers and sisters are baby boomers. They're older than me and I'm in Generation X. And then my daughter is in Generation Z, and then there's a bunch of small children running around, and what are they called? The alphas? I don't know, but it's something like that. So you have all these generations running around, and I just thought to myself, you know, I see a lot of differences. On social media, you'll see a lot of finger-pointing and jabbing from generation across the generation. And the thing that I wanted to point to is the difference in the generational experience from Generation Z and baby boomers. While baby boomers experience nothing but opportunity, Generation Z seems to have less to look forward to by a long shot. And so let me frame it up a little bit for context. So as I mentioned, my mom's 92. So when she was born, the country was in the Great Depression, and then it was World War II. And then, you know, it was good times. But imagine spending your youth worrying, 0 to 14. But then at least it was followed up by good times. For baby boomers, imagine living your entire life in relative prosperity, especially if you're white. Think about things like any job you wanted to create, you could have. Also, there were also pensions, and there was affordable housing, and there was a way to get a college education was affordable. So all these opportunities that the baby boomers have, that's their life. They were there first, coming out of this war that we were into, and society really gave them everything, not in a negative way. I'm not suggesting that it was wrong. Well, my point is that from government to companies, the baby boom has always been catered to and supported and provided opportunities, which is why I think a lot of times you see a lot of baby boomers who are most frustrated with the political climate because times have changed and they no longer feel, we all no longer feel that the country supports us. So the next piece, though, is, you know, while the baby boomer generation kind of ruled the nation and probably still does, the next generation down, Generation X, as they call it, was largely left alone. It's a small generation. But what I want to point out is that the generation began to see cracks forming. Jobs went overseas. When I was a kid, I worked in a town with a steel mill, and a lot of my friends moved because of that steel mill slowing. as a result of kind of this and being under the shadow of baby boomers, we just had no expectations. You know, I think that many of us never expected anything to work out for us. I mean, we still actually look at Social Security and Medicare as something that could be taken away right before we get there. I mean, I think a lot of us feel like our best plan is to just to survive, and we expect to have to fend for ourselves. And that's a mental illness issue. It's like no one's looking out for us, and we don't expect things to work out for us. But we don't really complain. We just kind of keep going. I think a lot of folks, most of the folks at Generation X would say we're a tough generation. It's a group that says it figures and just deals. Now, millennials, boomers' kids, I feel like they're more compassionate. And I see this when I look at my nieces and nephews. They were more loved and nurtured. They were also the recipients of participation awards and timeouts instead of spankings and first, second, third. But oddly, they seem to complain. And again, this is only what I've seen. They complain more about baby boomers than anyone else. And guess who raised them? But I do think it's important to talk for a minute about how I do feel there's a lot of compassion and a lot of equity, or at least seeking equity and seeking diversity, acknowledging it in millennials, which may not be as solid in those two older generations. And then while Generation X and millennials have lived through the slow dimming of the American glow, you know, the exceptionalism went from being exceptional to kind of gone, capitalism working to not working, democracy looking kind of uncertain right now. And so it's a distortion of the founding principles of the country. But America is certainly no longer perceived as innovative nor a beacon from health. And, you know, Generation X and millennials have watched that kind of happen in our lifetime. And Gen Z didn't even see it. And that's kind of a sad point, is they don't even think capitalism is good. They don't feel like there's equity in the world. So the sad part of all of this is that the odds then of this younger generation doesn't see opportunity, feels like the government isn't trustworthy, whereas other generations watched it decline. This is a group of people who doesn't have confidence from the get-go. And you layer in the fact that they don't see economic opportunity for themselves. They see climate change and no one's doing anything about it. And it would be hard not to have some despair. And then when you go back to what we were talking about, I mean, all of that contributes to the overarching mental illness of that generation. And then when you layer in, their only way of life is social media and that comparison culture and then individualism. So it's not really that surprising that there's this toughness and resilience that I'm seeing in Generation Z, but they're very hard. You know, my daughter is not afraid to jab me at all and be direct and critical. And I know that that generation is also very critical of millennials. And it'll be interesting to see what that gets them. They've had it with the way this country is run. And that's probably why the government is so afraid of things like TikTok and places like that, because it gives them a place to organize. So what's the solution to this problem, this generational chasm that we have? You know, I feel like one thing is we should really start thinking about our kids. You know, I mentioned alphas to start with, but we should be building, you know, between the three generations, we should really be focusing on an America and a world that allows our kids to prosper. And it really feels like we're just fending for ourselves and defending ourselves. So it's a mind shift to supporting our kids. Why are we stuck, honestly, with two old candidates for president? Old. Like, it's not clear that it's safe to have either Trump or Biden in the White House, in many cases, because it's not clear they're mentally capable or up to the task. And so the last thing I would say, you know, is we really need to unite again. And I say this because these gaps in generations really are divisive. You know, it's amazing to think that we have a younger generation that is completely disaffected with the entire notion of what America stood for, and an older generation which wants it back. And so, sure, you want it back, but, you know, how are you going to get there for your kids? Because they see socialism as making more sense than capitalism. They see wealth distribution as more sense than simply just taxing the rich. So it's these kinds of things that I believe we really need to kind of work together to fix. So the last topic that I wanted to talk about today was coping. And so I guess as I look back on this particular episode of the show, it really has been a lot about coping with the world around us. And maybe that's just because of what I'm dealing with personally. I don't really know. You know, I mentioned briefly over the last couple of years, they've been kind of difficult for me. And I know that people have more difficult lives than me, but a lot of this was very, very hard. And also since I was 14 years old, you know, I've been anxious. And it's been that way, and I've always been able to cover it up with self-medication or work or family or school, just finding ways to just wear myself out. But then anxiety, you can't suppress it forever. So when I've gone through situations, you know, I'm not always prepared, to be honest with you. And so recently this all came to a head because of a relationship I had that ended. And I started to go through this process that I think a lot of people with anxiety and depression go through, is you start with blaming yourself. You blame the other person or other people. You blame yourself. You're angry. You speculate about what others are doing. If it's a relationship, you may speculate about whether, you know, whether they're with someone else, whether it's at work, you speculate about whether people are talking behind your back or your boss is out to get you. So it becomes a spiral. And a lot of this comes from, you know, people get scared and start to think about things like you can't do your new job, or you're going to die alone, and things like that. And things get all over the map. So you're allowing all of these thoughts in your brain, and it's keeping you from doing anything. And a friend asked me a really good question. He says, how long are you going to let all of these thoughts not pay rent for them living in your brain? And I thought to myself, he's really good at sayings like that, but he's right. I'm letting, and maybe a lot of people are letting, frustration and anger and bitterness and speculation and worry and fear live in our brains and not pay rent. It's a rent-free system. And I think that we have an obligation to ourselves to, you know, either make them pay rent and be productive in our brains, or to kick them out. And all these things don't really help. So my approach has been one that my approach in the past has always been to focus on projects or New Year's resolutions related to achieving new things that I wanted to do, whether it's go on trips or advance my career or pick up hobbies or execute on exercise routines. But those projects were kind of empty. And I realized that what I really probably need to do, and what a lot of us can really do, is do something for us, do something for myself, and find peace. And a lot of that peace comes from either using the thoughts that are in your brain for something helpful for you and joyful for you and that inspires you, or kicking them out, just not even entertaining it. And a lot of this comes from, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they use the serenity prayer, and accept what I cannot change, have courage to change what I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. A lot of our first step, I think, in managing our mental health and dealing with a lot of these crises is just to accept the situation. As painful as it is, we can't look in the past. We can't look in the rearview mirror. And we also can't change the future or speculate about anything. All we can do is live in the moment. And that's very, very hard for people in their head who are overthinkers. And I recognize that. But this is the only thing I could land on in all of this was, it's just like the solutions piece of it. It's, we have to free our space, our mental space, and our world to do something positive and good, and not focus on the negative and the bad. Because in a lot of cases, the only way to fix anything that's negative and bad in our lives is to figure out what the good is, where the hope is, and things like that. So the thing that I'm thinking about for a resolution is really just to stop putting the burden on my brain and in my mind, and really focusing on accepting the situation and how I can improve myself, how I can improve the world around me, and just embracing the joy of being a person. And again, like I said, I've said a couple of times on this show, just being grateful to be able to come in here and talk and share my ideas. You know, that's a gift that a lot of people don't have. And you may not think it's such a gift, but I feel like I'm pretty lucky. But a lot of what I'm doing is just taking deep breaths and accepting the world around me, forgiving myself and others. And I just want to find peace. And I think that finding peace will help me and all of us address some of these issues, like generational differences and some of the social injustice and the economic injustice we face and things like that. I believe I'm not alone in some of this, so I hope you find that helpful. So I've got to bounce right now. Thanks a lot. I hope you enjoyed this show. Take care, everybody. Have a great day.